From Indiana to California, Hawaii to Kansas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, in the wake of the economic shutdown, the airline industry has received federal bailout money and will be looking for more. But should they get it? Veronique DeRugi from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to discuss. For the first time in history, the U.S. House of Representatives is allowing members to vote by proxy. That has raised constitutional issues. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. An Indiana man has his vehicle back after a high-profile asset forfeiture case. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Sam Gedge from the Institute for Justice. And many state governors have assumed extraordinary emergency powers during the COVID-19 pandemic, often trampling constitutional rights. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, says there will be a day of reckoning. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Air travel plummeted by over 90% when the nation went into its coronavirus shutdown. That led to a federal financial bailout. Should the airlines get more taxpayer dollars, or is bankruptcy a better option? To get the answer, we turn to Veronique DeRugi. Veronique is a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Veronique, before we start talking about potential bailouts or options that are available to the airline industry as they try to emerge from the pandemic that we are experiencing, tell us a little bit about the history of bailouts in airlines. Has this happened before?
Yes, this has happened before. The latest time it happened was obviously during 9/11, where companies basically said that no airline was strong enough to survive for a long time. Facing the upcoming challenges, they were saying at the time, without a bailout. So they got a $15 billion bailout. It's happened. It's happened before. And even before that, of course.
In terms of these bailouts, are we talking about money that they are just given by the federal government, or are these long-term, low-interest loans? How are these bailouts, particularly the last one that you just referenced, how have they been structured?
The last one, it was just they were given money. And I think kind of this time around, they're trying to kind of learn from the last experience. And they're just basically, there's this time around, there's structure between giving them money, but also lending them money. It's a mix of both.
Is this going to be part of, or is it proposed to be part of, the so-called phase four of the stimulus packages that Congress has passed? Is this part of that discussion, or is this a standalone?
There was already $50 billion in bailout that were actually given to airlines as part of the CARE Act. So they already received $50 billion in form of loans and different grants to different part of the airline industry, and there were some conditions and string attached to them. But the airlines are going to be coming back for more. So at some point, if the situation doesn't turn around and if people continue to not want to fly. So they've already received $50 billion.
Looking at this then, Veronique, you have the potential bailout. There's also the option of allowing various airlines to go into bankruptcy. Is bankruptcy in the long run a better option for airlines, even though they might not really look at it that way?
Yeah, absolutely. From the airline perspective, it's easier to get money from taxpayers. They would prefer to get it without string attached. They would prefer it to be just cash handed out to them for whatever they need. But even in the form of grants, they would rather receive money one way or another from taxpayers than actually go through a bankruptcy process. And yet, the bankruptcy process is actually meant for a situation like this. And it's a process that is a relatively simple process. It happens all the time. Airlines have gone through it several times. And during that process, what a bankruptcy judge usually does is that it keeps creditors at bay for a while. And and it allows the airline to restructure and to figure out a way to come out of bankruptcy on the other side with most of their assets intact. And by the way, when they are going through a bankruptcy process, first, it doesn't cost a dime to taxpayers, but also they can continue flying safely. We've seen it many times in the past. And the reason why the public is basically usually inclined to do bailouts for airlines is because it's presented to them as we don't bail them out. The airlines are going to go under and they're going to disappear entirely. And of course, that's just absolutely incorrect.
When you look at the bankruptcy process then, Veronique, the way you've described it, in terms of the long-term health of the airline industry, it sounds like a bankruptcy and a restructuring would put them in a healthier position than just a bailout. Because am I incorrect in saying if there's a bailout that doesn't require or force the airlines to address the underlying problems aside from the pandemic that have caused them to be in a financial distress anyhow?
Yeah, the bailout, one of the main problems with the bailout, apart from obviously the fact that this is pure cronyism, and it's the fact that it actually creates all sorts of very bad incentives. I mean, it is not a surprise to anyone who's studied these issues to know that companies or industries that have received bailout in the past are always the first one out of the gate when any crisis or recession or whatever happens to come and ask for another bailout. Right. And it creates this incentive to actually plan better. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, we're coming out of a 10-year growth with the economy doing extremely well. The airlines are very likely actually pretty well positioned to weather this storm. And it's a pretty big one. There's no doubt about this. It's a really big one. But their first instinct is to ask for a bailout. The other thing that people don't really often quite understand is, like, even if they haven't planned with a lot of cash on hand, which some of them have, but even if they haven't, the whole point of the bankruptcy is to actually get them to go through a process using and selling a lot of their assets that they have. In part, they can turn to their co-brand credit card issuing partner to get liquidity, which, by the way, a lot of airlines have done. I mean, they have a lot of ways before they go through the bankruptcy process to actually look for all sorts of solutions that they have to deal with that problem. And then it goes through the bankruptcy for the part that they can't handle. And the bankruptcy, what it does is it allows them to get some air from their creditors, but it also reassures the creditors that they will be paid back in the end. And so it's a healthy process, because when you come out of it, the airlines or companies, any companies that go through it, if they actually come out on the other end, they go into it and they are forced to restructure on the things that they really have to restructure. But the creditor are also getting a signal that basically it is still safe to lend to airlines because they're not going to be screwed over entirely the next time around. What bailouts do, they actually bail out shareholders, and usually creditors and workers are left in the dust.
We have been talking with Veronique Daruki, who is senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, as we typically do when we have you on the show, tell us a little bit about the Mercatus Center and where can folks go to read more.
So the Mercatus Center is a university-based research center. We're nonpartisan. We do have a free market position, and people can find all of our work at mercatus.org. And then if you want to look for particular scholars, you can find my work and pretty much everything I do in other places, not just at Mercatus, will be there, and same for all of my colleagues.
Veronique Daruki of the Mercatus Center. Veronique, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson, of course, is with the Club for Growth, and he joins us every week. We talk about what's happening in the nation's capital. Also, take a look at what's going on politically around the country. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks.
Let's talk about what's happening, or perhaps not happening, under the Capitol Dome in Washington. We've had some votes recently where the U.S. House of Representatives has been conducting business by proxy voting. Can you explain to us what that is and how it's working?
Earlier this month, Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats forced a rule through the House of Representatives allowing for proxy voting in case a member felt that their health or physical safety was threatened by coronavirus and were unable to physically get back to Washington, D.C. to cast their vote and represent their congressional district. So this week, the House returned, and we saw the precedent broken for the first time where members of the House of Representatives cast their vote via proxy. And what that meant was they submitted a letter to the clerk of the House and said that they felt that they were physically at risk of returning to Washington. And then they handed their vote over to another member of the House of Representatives. Underneath the rule, a single member can cast a vote on behalf of 10 of its colleagues. Now, the colleague is supposed to tell them via text message or phone call exactly how they want them to vote. But there's this big gray area that what if they're unable to be reached via email or via text message and there's no record of it? What if the staff just says, oh, you know, I think my boss would have been a yes? So it creates a real issue, a constitutional issue too, because the Constitution does say that the Congress needs to assemble and needs to have attendance and needs to conduct meetings. They didn't envision that it would be via Zoom or via text and email when the framers wrote our Constitution. It's something to keep in mind in terms of a lawsuit that's being brought forward by Kevin McCarthy and the House Republicans. They obviously, I think, have pretty strong grounding on the constitutional argument because representation does mean that you are in Washington. And when we've had the terrorist attack of 9/11, when they burned down the Capitol during the War of 1812, when we've had the Spanish flu pandemic, these were all instances where Congress didn't flinch in its constitutional duty to assemble in Washington. When the Capitol burned, they met at a hotel. And so this week, with the 71 Democrats that took advantage of proxy voting, it was pretty laughable because a couple of them happened to be members from Florida that were tweeting out their excitement to witness what was supposed to happen on Wednesday with the first crew flight for the Crew Dragon SpaceX launch. And Charlie Crist, our old chameleon friend down in Florida, and another member, Darren Soto, indicated on Twitter that they were going to be at the launch, and then they submitted a letter to the clerk of the House saying that they felt that they were physically unable to return to Washington to cast their vote. So it really is turning into an abdication of duty.
We will continue to keep an eye on that. Let's touch briefly on another subject here, Scott, while I have you. And that is the fact that the country is beginning slowly in some cases to reopen in the wake of this coronavirus pandemic. A lot of talk about sports, and how important do you think it is? We have the National Hockey League, looks like it's going to resume. Still waiting to hear from Major League Baseball, National Basketball Association. How important is it that we get sports restarted?
I think it's the single most important thing that can happen between now and the end of June when you talk about a reopening. And we're not talking about reopening with 20,000 people in an arena to watch the Los Angeles Lakers in the Staples Center. I think that people realize they're not going to be able to sit next to each other. But it does bring about a new confidence that we need as a country to see things getting back to normal. And some normalcy is sports being back in our lives. You've seen NASCAR. You saw this big match between Tom Brady and Peyton Manning and Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods on playing 18 holes together. And then you've got the National Basketball Association that really was a pivoting point of the economic shutdown when Utah Jazz's Rudy Gobert was diagnosed positive with the coronavirus. That's when basically everything started to shut down in March, and certainly the NBA suspended its season right then. So I think that if we bring back sports to a limited capacity of those that are team executives and trainers and coaches, umpires, referees, the players, maybe the players' families, finding a way to have a targeted region that can accommodate them with hotels and safe travel and clean facilities, that's going to be integral to getting sports to come back, at least for the short term. And so I think that that's what you're seeing now between the National Basketball Association, the Major League Baseball League, and the National Hockey League beginning to take the steps to resume their seasons. Soon later this summer, we're going to have mini camps starting for football, and you're also going to be seeing colleges have to make a decision on whether they're going to allow their college football teams to play and what that means for a student athlete. So I think that if we have this fall without college football, without the NFL, that you can kiss the economy goodbye, and it'll be a depression that's incredibly deep. But if we can maintain our food supply, if we can bring back sports and some entertainment to the country, then things are going to start to resume to normalcy. And the 40 million workers that have shed the economy so far will begin to return to work, because other folks, as states take steps to reopen, will feel more confidence to return to normal behavior.
You are very correct, Scott. Not only is this a health issue, it's a health issue, it's an economic issue, also a psychological one. And when we hear the words play ball, we will know we've turned a corner. Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Well, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're focused on economic freedom and opportunity and liberty. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. Our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4. And my favorite NFL player of all time was number 4, Brett Favre.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Take care.
It took some time and a lengthy trip through the courts, but an Indiana man and his vehicle have been reunited after fighting a high-profile asset forfeiture case. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Sam Gedge from the Institute for Justice. Eric?
Well, if you listen to this program with any sort of regularity, you've probably heard me talk about civil asset forfeiture. It's one of those things that just really gets my blood boiling, because it's a part of the criminal justice system that really isn't part of the criminal justice system at all. It means that if you get punished for committing a crime, then on top of whatever punishment the state is giving you, the state can also seize your assets, say your home or your car. And they can just keep it. They just oftentimes get to roll that right into their own budgets. It creates all sorts of perverse incentives. But thankfully, there are people out there who are working to fix this really messed up system, who are working to reform civil asset forfeiture. And we are going to talk with one of them today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Sam Gedge. He is an attorney at the Institute for Justice, and he's been one of the attorneys working on the Tyson Timbs case. We've had him here on the show a few times already to talk about it, and he's back today to give us some good news, actually. So, Sam, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Sam, we've talked about this case. In fact, as I said, I think I've had you on the program here to talk about it. It is one of, if not the most important civil asset forfeiture case that has ever gone before the U.S. Supreme Court. And the good news this week, and we definitely need some good news these days, the good news is that Tyson Timbs, your client, is finally getting back the vehicle that the state of Indiana tried to steal from him several years ago.
That's right. It's been almost 7 years to the day that law enforcement in Indiana seized Tyson's car. That was in the end of May 2013, I think. Earlier this week, Tyson got the car back pursuant to a court order that was issued a few weeks ago.
You guys won at the Supreme Court. That was more than a year ago already. And even though the case is still ongoing, we'll talk about that in a minute. But this was decided at the Supreme Court as an Eighth Amendment issue. Just give us a little reminder of what that means.
That's right. So Tyson's been fighting this case for 7 years. The Institute for Justice got involved a couple of years ago, but the case has really bounced around virtually every level of our nation's judicial system over the past half decade or more. But basically, Tyson was arrested back in 2013 for a low-level drug crime. He pleaded guilty to the crime, been a model citizen ever since. But the state of Indiana has been far more interested in taking his Land Rover. So they filed a civil forfeiture case against it, and that case has been winding on now for years. Ended up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, which issued really a landmark ruling last year on the question whether the excessive fines clause in the Eighth Amendment even applies to state and local governments at all. And the court I think unsurprisingly said that of course it does. And since then, we've been fighting about whether Tyson should get his car back under the excessive fines clause.
Yeah, this was a $42,000 vehicle, Tyson Timms's truck. It was worth far more money than what the state of Indiana says is the maximum fine that is allowed as punishment for the crime that Timms was convicted of having committed. And so taking the vehicle is what the Supreme Court said amounted to an excessive fine. And that's why the state now has to return the truck to Tyson Timms. We are talking with Sam Gedge. He's an attorney with the Institute for Justice. Sam, we mentioned earlier that this case is still ongoing. I wonder if you can explain a little bit about that, because I think the layman's understanding of the court system is that case works its way through up to the Supreme Court, kind of goes up the ladder, and then the Supreme Court has its say, and that's the end of it. You know, it's the highest court in the land, after all. But that's not actually how things have worked here, and the state of Indiana is still appealing this decision.
Yeah, that's right. So the U.S. Supreme Court last year kind of decided a threshold issue, right, whether the excessive fines clause applies at all to state governments. And having decided that it does, the Supreme Court sent the case back to the Indiana Supreme Court to hash out what the Eighth Amendment standard looks like. The Indiana Supreme Court sent it back to the trial court. We won there last month. And now the Indiana Attorney General's office is bringing us back up to the Indiana Supreme Court. So kind of the path of this case is incredibly convoluted. But I think the important thing for right now is that for the first time in 7 years, Tyson has his property back, at least while the appeal is pending.
Yeah, back and forth, up and down the ladder it goes. Just about a minute left here, Sam. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, just kind of broaden this out and tell us how this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court might change the legal situation for civil asset forfeiture more broadly in cases that go well beyond the one you're dealing with here with Tyson Timms.
That's absolutely right. So the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the excessive fines clause provides some check to state and local governments when they want to fine people or forfeit their property. So that was an unsettled question of law up until last year. Most courts who have considered it, you know, thought that, of course, this part of the Bill of Rights applies to the states. But that question's off the table now. And that's important because the excessive fines clause really is a backstop, and it acts as a check on some of the worst abuses that we see when it comes to fines and forfeitures.
So some good news here, good news in the short term, Tyson Timms is finally getting his truck back from the state of Indiana, and good news in the long term that this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court could pave the way for more decisions that restrict when law enforcement can use civil asset forfeiture. And that just means, I suspect, more work for you, Sam, and for your colleagues at the Institute for Justice, but work that I'm sure you don't mind doing. Thanks for taking some time and joining us today.
Thank you.
And again, that is Sam Gedge. He's an attorney at the Institute for Justice. You can check out their work at ij.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can find our coverage of the Timms case, civil asset forfeiture, and lots of other stuff at reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
In many states, constitutional protections guaranteed by the Bill of Rights have been trampled by governors who have abused emergency powers during the coronavirus pandemic. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
COVID-19, the coronavirus, has perhaps done more to underscore the concerns that our citizens have about their rights as citizens of the United States of America than anything else. The unchecked powers of a governor upon declaration of an emergency have raised the specter of fear in the hearts of patriots throughout our great nation. Freedoms previously taken for granted are being challenged by the extraordinary powers given by the state legislatures to their governors in past years. The rebellion against these draconian measures has begun in Illinois, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and a host of other states. State legislatures found themselves in a quandary which no one expected. The complete abuse of laws meant to protect the public under very unusual circumstances. No one expected that such an abuse of power could rest almost unchecked upon the whim of one executive, a governor, and a secretary of health who was unelected. Citizens, within 30 days of the quarantine being in effect, began to question their constitutional rights that were so severely limited during the pandemic. The stay-at-home orders and the determination of life-sustaining versus non-essential workers became a takings without due process, creating confusion when state courts upheld the laws creating this emergency declaration. Upholding these laws seemed to be in contradiction to our rights under the Constitution of the United States of America. The Bill of Rights seemed to no longer apply, thereby confusing most citizens who felt that such rights were sacred, guaranteed, and no longer in danger of being lost. Their property and their right to work were taken without compensation and or explanation. The right of free assembly was stripped. Freedom of religion was threatened overnight. Hospitals were shut down for elective surgeries. Unemployment skyrocketed. Massive stimulus bills in the trillions of dollars were passed, thrusting the nation deeper into debt. Cries and exhortations about our constitutional rights seemed to fall on deaf ears. As time passed, the discontent increased and will continue to escalate. The public began to realize that the very framework of the government that they thought was there to protect them was in fact denying them the right of self-determination and other basic freedoms. The history of the founding of our nation and our Constitution shows that this debate about individual rights and freedoms has been a struggle since our founding. The Constitution itself did not include a Bill of Rights. Those Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, did not come about until years after the Constitution was ratified. Those rights under the Bill of Rights evolved. The Civil War created the climate in which additional amendments, particularly the 14th Amendment, was added to the Constitution, which amplified whether the Bill of Rights applied to the states as well. This one sentence in the 14th Amendment had and continues to have long-lasting implications on the application of the Bill of Rights to the states, and I quote, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws," unquote. The Due Process Clause has been interpreted as applying the Bill of Rights, which lists the rights and privileges and immunities of citizens, to the states. The source for this is usconstitution.net, and they said it's known as the incorporation or the application of the bill to those states that did not come all at once, nor is its incorporation complete. Even today, there are some parts of the bill which have not been incorporated. The Supreme Court began to accept in the 1940s the argument that the 14th Amendment requires the states to follow the protections of the Bill of Rights. Historians both agreed and disagreed with the court's contention. So, as the pandemic hopefully subsides, the battle over the unchecked emergency powers of the governors of the 50 states will begin in earnest. The challenges that will occur as a result of those poorly designed laws, giving such powers to the one chief executive and a secretary of health, will see greater definition and clarity because of the abuses seen in so many of the states during this crisis. The very fabric of our nation and the rights inherent of our people are at stake. The rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights and our U.S. Constitution should be the highest law in the land. State legislators, governors, and state courts need greater clarity of what their role is and is not during an emergency. Until then, the legislature yields the power of the budget to rein in an out-of-control governor, but that's about it. To have thought that COVID-19 would pinpoint such weaknesses in our rights was unfathomable at the beginning of 2020, but it will become the rallying cry of our republic until it is fixed. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WJAS-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WFYL-AM in Jeffersonville, Pennsylvania, along with KADA-FM in Ada, Oklahoma. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.